the truth behind how people really succeed is pretty boring stuff. And I think that's one of the major issues that I've seen is that what we in general attribute our successes to ourselves and we disregard the external factors. Sometimes that's just pure luck.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, information that will make your wildest dreams come true, writing your own self-help book, and I Say Goodbye. All coming up next. Hello, everybody. This is Bo Bennett, and welcome to my last episode of the Humanist Hour, I am sad to say. It's been one heck of a fun ride, and part of me is very sad to go, but I am moving on to other things. I've been doing this for about 2 years now, but I always knew this was a temporary gig, so it's time to turn over the reins to somebody else. Well, for my last show, I wanted to do something a little bit different, kind of going back to my roots, if you will. Prior to this life, I was very involved in motivational speaking. Companies would actually pay me money to visit them and just talk about different topics. A lot of times I did talk about business and some actual real strategies. I kind of dabbled in pseudopsychology because this was way before my science days, but I also talked a lot about motivation. And as I started to learn more about science and get into critical thinking, I started pulling away from the motivational talk and from what I've been doing in the kind of the self-help world, if you will, because I just realized that so much of it was just such a bunch of crap, and I just could not bring myself to do it anymore. So eventually I got out of it completely, and it's very much like stepping out of religion. It's not a quick overnight thing, but it takes some time to realize how wrong you were on so many different issues. Academically, I was introduced to positive psychology, which was very much like the self-help movement. However, it was different in that it was empirically based. It wasn't just thrown out hype and motivation and just a lot of platitudes. There was actual science behind it, and it was backed up by the scientific method. So the things that were said in positive psychology, you could actually believe with a good amount of confidence. So after about 2 years of criticizing other people's beliefs, I figured, why not look at myself from 10 years ago and talk about some of the things that I really believed in and was all for 100%. And it is, again, really much like coming out of a religion. It's just a secular religion. So I'm going to be talking with my friend Michael Britt, who has a lot of experience in this area as well. So I'm going to be bringing him on, and we're going to have a fun discussion about the self-help industry. And then after, I'll kind of wrap up the story and tell you a little bit more about myself and my book that I wrote, kind of a self-help book about 10 years ago. So here we go with my interview with Dr. Michael Britt. And I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Michael Britt. How are you, sir?
Hiya, Bo. Good to talk with you again.
Good talking with you again. So we're going to have a little fun today. We're going to be talking about how to write a self-help book.
Exactly.
But we're not really teaching people how to write a self-help book. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek. There you go. There's a lot of problems with the self-help industry. And this really relates back to critical thinking, which is a lot what we talk about here on the Humanist Hour. So I think it's really good to get into the whole area of self-help and how it relates to psychology and some philosophy and so forth. And both of us have a pretty good background in this. Both of us have PhDs in psychology, but also I happen to have written what might be considered a self-help book about 10 years ago, a 780-page self-help book.
Wow-wee.
So I've got a little background on this as well. So we're going to have some fun and talk about it. How do you want to kick this off?
Well, I'll just tell you the reason why, you know, I contacted you and said, hey, Bo, let's do it. Let's do something on this. And that, I think, has to do with me being old.
Okay.
So I'm in my 50s, and I have to admit, I've been interested in psychology since I was a teenager. And yes, I purchased a lot of these books back then. And amazingly, maybe not amazingly, many of them are still around today. So, you know, 30 years later, 40 years later, you see these books on the shelves, and then you just see new ones come out all the time. And at first, I mean, nowadays I just don't even look anymore, but for a while I was like, wow, what could be new here? And then you look at it and you go, but this is the same stuff that was been said years ago.
Right. Right.
And then you start to see these trends and you say, oh, gosh, this is just rehashed stuff. Some of it's not very good.
That's exactly it. What I also do on the side, my main business, I guess, is I publish ebooks. And mm-hmm. we get a lot of ebook submissions, and all the time, many of them are in the self-help genre. And just as you say, if you read the summaries or you read the first couple pages, the first chapter, whatever, they're all basically the same stuff, just repackaged. So we see this all the time.
Yeah, I think the best/worst example of this would be The Secret.
Oh, jeez.
Right? I mean, it's...
right.
But there's a scary end to this, too. You know, it's sort of... Because on one hand, you could say, okay, well, it's good. I mean, there are some good ideas that have grown out of psychology and ancient thinkers. But a lot of the books, I think, make some promises that are just not good. They boomerang, and people wind up feeling not so good about themselves.
Absolutely. All right. Let me kick this off by telling a little story, because most of our listeners have been listening to me talk for almost 2 years now, and they really don't know a heck of a lot about my background outside of the humanist area. About 10 years ago, actually it was 2004, after I sold my first company of significant value, I decided to write a book. I wanted to put down everything I've learned into one book, because my kids were young at the time, and I said, you know, heaven forbid anything ever happen to me, I want to be able to pass it on to them. I want to be able to pass on this knowledge of what I've learned. So it was that kind of project, and I was the kind of kid that grew up, since I was 10 years old, I was listening to everything, all self-help stuff, because my sister was in real estate and my mom was a salesperson for some magazine company. So they both had all of the tapes, you know, the Dennis Waitley's, the Anthony Robbins, you know, they've had all of them. So when I was working for my dad, I used to listen to all this stuff, and I used to get pumped up, completely and totally pumped up. And I used to buy all the books. I used to go to some seminars with my sister. So anyway, in 2004, I wrote the book Year to Success, and it was about 750 pages or so, 780 pages.
Man, that must have taken
a year. It took a full year to write, full time, every day writing. It was a long project. It was a great project. I really enjoyed doing it. So I shopped. This was before self-publishing, so I was shopping it around to publishers, and every single publisher I went to that actually responded to me, they said, you know, We like the concept, but you got to change the title. Nobody wants to wait a year for success. So why don't you and they gave me suggestions like, how about like the three secrets or the four keys or the seven, whatever. It's always like three and seven and two or whatever. They wanted something that sold, something that grabbed people's attention, that were lazy, and they didn't want to wait a year. You know, they didn't want to do the work for it. And I explained to them, I said, no, that's not how it works. This book is kind of like anti all of those books. And the whole book is all about how it takes a long time. And it's all about improving yourself on a day-to-day basis. And after all that stuff accumulates, then you're going to be much better off. And this takes time. It's a process. They did not want to hear it. So I ended up
that sounds
self-publishing
dull.
It that's exactly it. It was dull. So that's my story with the whole idea of over-promising and under-delivering, which most of these books clearly do.
Yeah. That's true.
And that's perhaps why.
Yeah. I mean, if you can't get me fit in 7 minutes a day, I'm off to the next book.
Right. Right.
Yeah. The truth behind how people really succeed is pretty boring stuff. You know? And I think that's one of the major issues that I've seen is that we in general attribute our successes to ourselves and we disregard the external factors, sometimes that's just pure luck. And I remember one time I was walking through Barnes and Noble, you know, I mean, I do love books, and I saw a book by an Olympian, you know, one of those famous figure skaters, and it was all about how to be successful. And I didn't even open the book. I just looked at it and I thought, you know, you are what, 18 maybe? You're young, you're fit, you're beautiful, you've been successful in the Olympics. What do you know, about struggle and working? I mean, I know you worked hard, but do you in this book mention all of the times that your parents dragged you off to practice and how you hated it?
Do they mention genetics?
I doubt they do, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it just seems when you see really young people writing success books, I don't know.
Well, that's kind of the key that you hammered on. One of the big problems with these books, the self-help books, they're based on this idea that if I could do it, you could do it too. Mm-hmm. And it's very unidimensional. That is, it's very, they're thinking, look, I did it, so you could do it. Binary. I did it, you do it. Rather than the way life really works. Okay, I did it, but I did it because of tons of different factors that went into my success, including both biological and environmental, and circumstances, and like you said, parents, and maybe being born in the right country, in the right place, mm-hmm. to the right parents, in the right time. So many factors that you don't even think about, because it's uncomfortable to think about all these things. It's uncomfortable to think about the fact that I'm successful has a heck of a lot to do with pure luck. And I like to think that the fact that I'm successful has to do with all me, you know, because of my smarts and because of my personality. And that's what the way people write these books, like, okay, everything is internal rather than external. They just completely ignore these external factors.
Yeah, you know, I was telling, I think maybe my class the other day, that I think that as I get older, I become when I was younger, I wasn't really a behaviorist, you know, I just thought Skinner was nuts. And then as you get older, you realize that a lot of who you are has been shaped by your environment. We like to, one of the things that I liked about what Skinner said at one time is he said, you know, we can't fall in love with our emotions. And he actually, when you listen to him talk, he's a pretty reasonable fellow. And what I took out of him saying that was along these lines. Our thoughts are so salient to us. We think and then we act. It must be my thoughts that cause the things to happen in my life, because I know I have thoughts, but you don't see the stuff. And then you look backwards, you do a little hindsight bias, and you look back on your life, and then you create a story that you start to believe about why you were successful, when actually many of those factors probably were not the reasons you were successful.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Britt about self-help. And I think that's a key point, too, that we just need to hit on, is this idea that many people believe that everything originates with thoughts. Mm-hmm. They don't go beyond that to think, okay, well, wait, where did these thoughts come from? What caused these thoughts? And this has a lot to do with, I guess, free will. It gets into it, contra-causal ideas, a lot of philosophy. But at least from a psychological perspective, we know that thoughts, and there have been many social psychology experiments that prove this, that you could get people to to react and behave in a certain way by changing the social situation, mm-hmm. by influencing them, by persuading them, by saying certain things. You could get them essentially to think certain things that causes them to act or behave in a certain way. So we know that there are things that precede thoughts, but a lot of in these self-help books, they really kind of take that position that everything originates with these thoughts, but and forget the very important part. Whoa, where do the thoughts come from?
When I see books like The Secret and others that just advocate changing the way you think, first off, they make it sound like it's easy, and there's been research that shows that when people are told that something should be easy, and then they do it, and then they don't succeed, they actually end up feeling worse afterwards. And that's but how do you sell a book that essentially, you know, says, hey, I got lucky. That kind of thing doesn't sell books.
Right. There are good ideas in these books. The problem is there's probably just one or two good ideas that you could easily get from a sentence or two. But you have to read through these 200, 300, 400 pages of fluff, essentially, in order just to get these couple ideas. And the ideas that are in these books, most of them are not new or groundbreaking. I mean, they're ideas that have been passed along for a long time.
Yeah, if you study psychology, then a lot of these ideas are found among the cognitive psychologists. So you read people like Martin Seligman, Aaron Beck, Albert Ellis. You know, is it good to think about things in a positive, constructive way? Yeah, sure it is. Absolutely. And that's about it.
Right.
You know, I mean, they go a little further and they get very specific. But, you know, it kind of boils down to that. Interpreting your experience in a positive way is a good thing. But the self-help books, some of them, like The Secret, promise way, way too much.
And they also, of course, some of them border on woo and some of them dive right into it. And I would say The Secret is definitely one of those. Let's talk about The Secret for a moment. We mentioned it a bunch of times. Plus, it's a great example of how you could take like a psychological principle and completely, totally bastardize it. Mm-hmm. and try to fancy it up, surround it in mysticism, and then market it. And The Secret is a perfect example of how that's been done. So, of course, we have the law of attraction, right? And from a classic psychological perspective, the law of attraction is essentially just the idea that the more we think about things that we want, the more likely we are to focus our efforts and our attention on getting those things. It's pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. So, for example, if we want to lose weight, if we want to look good, we may have a picture of a person with an ideal body that we would like to have, and we constantly look at that, and it serves as a reminder, and it keeps us on path, and it keeps our goals focused. And it keeps us from breaking some of those goals, like having a candy bar or so. So that definitely does work. But of course, with the Secret, they've taken that in a complete different direction. And they talk about, like you said, like vibrations throughout the universe. And they never mention God, but it's kind of like God is the universe, kind of like a pantheistic type of religion, where the universe is providing for people. And there's this one example that sticks with me, and it bothers the heck out of me because it's just so ridiculous. And if you've seen the video, the video is even worse than the book. But the example was like this kid really wanted a bike for his birthday or something. He wanted a bike, and he kept on thinking about it. And then like the next day, it appeared on his porch with like a big bow. And the idea, of course, is the vibration somehow did it, as opposed to the fact that who knows what happened. You know, he was begging his parents until his parents couldn't take it anymore and bought the kid the damn bike. But it's that, yeah, it's that whole idea of taking like a solid principle, whether it be psychological or whether it be just something that has been demonstrated common sense even, and then shrouding it in mysticism or completely changing it and exaggerating and then writing 400 pages about it and sticking it in a book.
I heard something similar to that, which is that someone recommended that if you needed a parking spot at a mall, that on your way there, you needed to just visualize an empty spot.
Right.
You know, and then when you get there, it would be there. And you know what? I mean, is this going to happen? Sure. It is.
Statistically.
We are going to find coincidences in our lives, and we're going to find that, hey, well, I thought about this and it happened. But we don't think about, well, I thought about this and it didn't happen. I'm sure that happens a lot more often.
Right. Right.
You wish for something and you don't get it. But we don't remember those times because there's nothing remarkable to remember about that. But it occurs more often.
You remember the hits and forget the misses.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you mentioned visualization, and that's an interesting concept because, again, that's something that has been demonstrated scientifically, that it has been effective. There have been studies. There's this one study where the researcher took a whole group of basketball players. He divided them into three different groups. Right. One group practiced 20 minutes a day. One group just visualized for 20 minutes a day. And the other group did nothing. The group that visualized was about just as good as the group that actually practiced.
Right. I mean, you're not going to become Michael Jordan or something. Right. But that is a good way. I think I've heard about that with golf. Is it worth doing? Sure. You know, is it going to make you incredible? No, it's worth doing.
It's worth doing. And you could see the difference between that, like something that you're visualizing that you have control over, you're concentrating, you're focusing, you're removing distractions, and that will help you perform better. So you could actually see the science behind this and see how it works. Whereas the example that you gave, like trying to visualizing a parking spot, this is something that you absolutely have no control over. It's not something that within your control that you can do. So all the visualization in the world is not going to help you get that parking spot. And that's essentially the whole theme of the secret. It doesn't matter if you're directly connected to what you're thinking about or what you're attracted to. Whereas in the real world, yes, it does matter. You have to have these connections in order to get that thing.
In that case, you can't explain how it would work. You know, I remember not long ago, someone was going to remotely diagnose me. I was feeling, you know, physically not well. And so when I realized, and this is an intelligent person, you know, I was like, oh, I said, well, what is it you're going to do? And she couldn't explain it exactly. It had to do with, thinking about me and you know,
boy,
asking questions of the universe. And I said to her, I tried to be respectful and just say, well, how would that work? And, you know, of course, I'm just looking for some mechanism. I don't know, and she couldn't explain it. And it forces, energies, vague things of that nature.
All right. Yeah. And did she throw out quantum in there somewhere?
No, that would have been good. I hear that's very popular.
Right. Well, that's important in science. You have to have a mechanism. When you're trying to come up with a theory or come up with a hypothesis or something, it ultimately results to some kind of mechanism. You have to be able to explain why X causes Y or so forth. And if you don't have this mechanism, that's a big piece of the puzzle missing. It doesn't mean that it's worthless. So if you're missing a mechanism, if you could keep on proving without this mechanism that there is some connection there, then you keep looking for that mechanism. But the problem is, it's just not there to begin with, and they don't have the data to back it up, and they don't have the track record to back it up. So it's just a bunch of nonsense. You mentioned some biases before. There are a lot of biases involved in self-help. Before you mentioned the fundamental attribution error.
Right. When we look at other people, we attribute, we tend to attribute their actions to their personalities, particularly when they do something stupid.
Right.
if they fall down, we call them a klutz. You know, so we just have ways of interpreting success and failure that are inconsistent. And as a teacher, you probably know when students succeed and they do well, it's because they, they're pretty smart. You know, they got this. But if they fail, then, well, it's this, that, you know, the teacher, the test, and all these other things. You know, so attribution errors, how we explain what happens to us. And we twist reality in a lot of ways so that we end up feeling good about the explanation.
Right. Yeah. Well, we began this conversation by throwing out that tongue-in-cheek title, How to Write a Self-Help Book. So why don't we get into some of those ideas? So the commonalities that we see in a lot of these type of books. So I'll kick it off with one of the first that I could think of. Okay. What I see so often is authors who have become wealthy or become famous because they wrote the book on how to become wealthy or famous. it's the whole idea of fake it till you make it. And you can't really go back, and at least before the internet especially, you couldn't really look up everybody's past and history and see that they're a bunch of, they're full of it. But a lot of people what they did is they just made up a lot of crap, and they made themselves sound a heck of a lot more successful and rich than they really were. So, and they use that as the basis for writing the book. And then, of course, as they sell more and more books, they actually become richer mm-hmm. and more famous.
Yeah, it's
so that's one way to do it.
Well, I've got a list of 10 things. At least I think I got 10. I might have an 11 that you should do if you are going to want to write a self-help book.
All right.
You want to get ready for them?
Let's go.
All right. First, be humble. And in other words, you have to claim in your book, you don't always have to, depends upon, you know, which approach to self-help you're going to take. But usually if you think you've got a really good idea, you have to sell it as something that just kind of happened. It just came to you. It's just like, and I don't know, it happened to me. And then I remember hearing this self-help guy, he was talking about, well, I went out and I was thinking about it, and it just sort of, and now scientists are studying it. As right. If, well, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I just happened to be the channel.
Yeah,
I'm, this false humility.
Right. Hey, I'm just the receptor here of the universe's message.
And I remember watching an amazing Randy video some years ago, and he was talking about the people who do these mental tricks. And he said, it's very important to say, and you know, I don't know how that happens.
Right.
You got to be humble. Okay, so how are you going to take a couple of good ideas and make a 250-page book? Well, you have to first you got to sprinkle the book with definitions from Webster's dictionary. You'll see that in every self-help book because according to Webster, and then they go on I don't know why, but it looks like you've really looked. You have to make it look like you have looked and read some really boring books, nothing that the reader would want to read, but you did it.
Right. I've seen the line, I've read these books so you don't have to.
Exactly.
I'm like, just trust me on this stuff.
Yeah. And if you're going to quote anybody, you got to quote people like the Greeks or Plato or Socrates or Lao Tzu or Sun Tzu. You got to, these people that, or of course, quote the Bible too. You got to quote books that and sources that no one's probably going to look up.
All right. And the key is that they're dead. For some reason, after somebody dies, they become a heck of a lot wiser than they were when they were living. And that's a fallacy known as the appeal to ancient wisdom, which is very common.
I knew you'd have a fallacy behind that.
I've got a fallacy for everything.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, and if the person's dead, then you can't ask them if they actually said it.
Right. And yeah, and what do you mean by that, too? Oh, I don't know. I was drunk when I actually wrote that.
Which reminds me of a story, I think it was John Lennon told, of a guy who, when they were big back in the 60s, and so some guy got onto their property then where the Beatles were staying, and he was just like, what did you mean, by when you said that in the song? and he just said to the guy, I can't tell you, it's song, I just made up the lyrics.
All right. Well, it rhymed with the word before.
Exactly. So we underestimate because we think that people on TV, people who've written books, they must know things that the rest of us don't know.
Right.
And so we assume that what they're saying is very heavy when actually it may not, it's just not.
Exactly. And there's this idea that if something was written a really long time ago, like the Bible or any holy books, and it still exists today, then every single word in that must be golden. It must really have a deep meaning to it, behind it or something. And then, of course, with the Barnum effect and many other psychological things, you attribute your own meaning to words, or and it could really mean whatever you want it to mean.
Well, it's like Nostradamus. Right?
Oh yeah, that's a classic.
Isn't he famous for that?
Right, especially when you make thousands of predictions.
Yeah, when you make a million of them, they're all vague. You can say, look at that, he predicted the fall of the Twin Towers. How do you know? Well, this and this stands for that, and right. This means this. This is another word for tower. So other ways to fill out your self-help book, make sure to use lots of parables and stories. You got to tell lots and lots of stories. Essentially, you got that one or two good idea, which you probably stole from someone who thought about it a while ago. Right. But then, you know, make up stories, especially ones about, people who have succeeded, or CEOs, or people who started up a company in their garage. Pick and choose. You know, I bet a lot of people have started companies in their garages that just failed.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But if you're not going to pick those, you know, you got to pick the ones that make the reader feel good, make them feel excited and inspired.
And, you know, I always wondered how many people actually moved their business to the garage instead of like an office in their nice warm house or something, just for that whole idea that it's starting in a garage. And they could say, I started it in my garage.
I don't know. If I started something in my garage, I'd be cold all the time.
Yeah, I don't know if you could do that in New England here. Right.
All right. The next thing you got to do is you have to hire some kind of a data visualization person, somebody who could take your idea and then like draw it out into some kind of a diagram or a flow. You got to have some diagrams in your book to make it look like what you're talking about is really complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a, I'm pretty sure there's some science behind this. The idea if there is an image associated with something, people tend to believe it more. Even if it's not true. And I know there's a lot of research that was done with neuroscience and brain scans.
Right.
So if you attach a brain scan to something, then people tend to believe it a heck of a lot more because, ooh, it's a brain scan. You know, they have no idea what the brain scan shows. It's just the brain with all the different colors in it. And then they say, oh, yeah, therefore, whatever the writing is or the text underneath it or what the brain scan is supposed to represent, it must be true. They tend to believe it more. So I think the same thing is going on with all these little images and fancy diagrams. If you try to throw those in your book to enhance your message, you're tricking people, but it works. It's effective.
Yeah, I mean it makes it look like it's really complicated, and which supports the sense that you are a very special person who's able to come up with something that needs to be explained using very complex imagery.
Right.
So you must be a smart person.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Britt about self-help.
Other people, in addition to the Greeks and Plato and Socrates and Sun Tzu, that you want to mention, of course, you want to mention Maslow, because everybody's heard of him, you know, And part of Maslow's ideas were fine, and they were good, they were uplifting, but they're, you know, a little bit basic. You know, it's sort of, I don't know, it doesn't take a genius to come up with it. I mean, I don't want to put the guy down. He was well-meaning, and you know, it's a nice little hierarchy. But there was a great article that came out a long time ago called Is Science Marketing? And basically, the point they were trying to make is that the theories that we know, most people know, are the ones that lent themselves to easy visualizations or easy ways to remember them. And Maslow's hierarchy is just this thing. Everybody has seen it. And, you know, just, oh, well, yeah, I know that. That part I know. You know, so use it. Go with it.
Yeah, it's like the food pyramid for psychology.
Yeah, yeah. So you want to mention Maslow. I think you want to mention Carl Jung, another name that people think, oh, yeah.
Well, let's talk about Carl Jung for a moment, because there's an interesting connection there with psychology and pseudoscience. I think like Deepak Chopra is kind of like the modern day Carl Jung, right? I think it's the same kind of, you know, you take a little science and then you build a lot of, you put a lot of mystery around it and spiritualism. And then you try to pass it off as legitimate science. But it, like you said, yeah, this guy, Carl Jung, he had a lot of good ideas. And he was one of the early guys in psychology. But you take those ideas and you take what works and you keep it. And all the rest of the stuff you throw away. But what a lot of people do is they don't throw that stuff away. They refer to him as like a legitimate psychologist, which he was. But then they take all his ideas and they try to legitimize their own like spiritual or mystical ideas as a science because he did it like 100 years ago or whatever, 80 years ago. And you just can't do that.
Yeah, I think the when his name comes up is when an author wants to claim that everything happens for a reason. And this is a catchy one because we because some of the reasons we've already mentioned, we have a tendency, it's confirmation bias. We, you know, we can make meaning out of just about anything that happens and claim that, you see, I knew it was going to happen, or it makes total sense, you know, but we, because again, chance is just no fun.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, Jung talked a lot about synchronicity and that's a big word. So make sure if you're writing a self-help book that, you know, you're taking a big word like synchronicity and, you know, just making it a little easier for the average guy to understand that, you know, this famous guy, Carl Jung, meant that everything happens for a reason. I think that's the end of my top 10. Oh, there's the other one you might want to use is alliteration, you know, because people like that. It's just like having a catchy title. A catchy title or using alliteration. I saw one recently. It was called Marketing with Meaning. So you got to use those M's, you know, you just or whatever you can come up with that makes it sound, well, I mean, it really just makes it memorable.
Right, right. And that's closely related to the rhyme as reason effect. And that's this phenomenon where if you tend to rhyme something, people tend to believe it more as opposed to something that's not rhymed. So like if you have two different statements, like one, birds of a feather flock together, versus people who are the same hang out together. If you say something like that versus birds of a feather flock together, people will be significantly more likely to believe the one that rhymes, even though they mean the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's the key is to make it rhyme, to make it sound good.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you're saying reminds me of a book I read some years ago. It was called Words That Work. And it was apparently written by someone in politics who people go to ask, how do we word this in a way that will sound positive? And I think he was the one who came up with the Freedom Act, you know. And it's not going to be called the "we're going to watch over you and keep a close eye on you." You know, we have to word it in ways that guide the listener towards a visualization that's positive.
If you want to be a good marketer and you want to sell your ideas or sell whatever you have to sell, and I struggle with this all the time, like as a business person. And the more I've been delving into critical thinking, I find it more difficult to do this because I see the little tricks that I've been using. I've been using them kind of subconsciously in the past. I've been using them thinking that everything's legitimate and everything, and I believed it. But now that I know kind of the trickery behind it and I know how it's kind of tricking people, I have a really difficult time using it. And if I don't, I see that like the marketing results just aren't as good, you know. So it's you got to find this balance between, you know, using a little bit of this stuff without actually going into deception or ripping people off or lying especially. So I think there's a balance there. When we talk about this, I can't help but thinking about this clip in this movie Mystery Men with Ben Stiller. It's very funny. I'll play it for you now.
Why do you stand aside while the others practice?
Practice? That's not practicing. That's group hugging. We should be busting in on Casanova right now.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
To summon your power for the conflict to come, you must first have power over that which conflicts you.
Okay, am I the only one who finds these sayings just a little bit formulaic? If you want to push something down, you have to pull it up. If you want to go left, you have to go right.
Your temper is very quick, my friend. But until you learn to master your rage...
Your rage will become your master? That's what you were going to say, right? Right?
Not necessarily.
I got one final way that you can be a success in the self-help arena.
How's that?
That's to make sure that, well, there's two things you can do. First off, if you devote, in order to get your 250 or 300 pages, make sure to have little activities for the reader to do. So you can leave empty spaces with lines in tell them to write in it.
Right, yeah.
Nobody does it, right? But it really uses up a lot of space. That's just great if you can do that. And then the last one would be even better maybe is if you could make a workbook that goes along with your book. Because if you get this wave of interest in your book, well, people will buy your workbook too. And the workbook, of course, has the same ideas as the book does, but it has lines and spaces for you to write out your words.
Right. So instead of using a pad of paper for a penny sheet, you spend what, 50 cents per sheet on that workbook. Yeah. Makes sense.
I don't think we're going to get rid of self-help books. What can you do? It is good. I mean, people want to feel, it's like trying to think about, well, I'm going to get rid of motivational videos. No, I mean, people like to feel good. I like to feel good. You know, I want to feel good too. So we'll probably always see various incarnations of the same ideas.
Well, I'd like to leave this on a kind of a positive note.
Oh, okay,
and I think we should mention some of the pluses with this kind of genre. And we should certainly admit that there are books of different qualities, right? I mean, some books are just horrible that kind of they use every little thing that we talked about in this podcast. Whereas other books, they're pretty good, and they're good because maybe they have, like, they kind of stick with the scientific method, and they're backed by evidence, and they have they use empiricism maybe, and it's just some good advice that people that maybe people wouldn't get otherwise. One area where these books are helpful is it with motivation and inspiration. A lot of these books, and I remember, I'm just thinking back to when I was like 10 years old and when I was a teenager and I would listen to these things. I really didn't understand a heck of a lot that was going on. I didn't understand what the authors were saying and a lot of the financial stuff they were talking about, but I did pick up on their excitement and their motivation and just the kind of a whole idea that it's possible. You know, maybe they oversold it, but I didn't care at that point. So there is that motivational aspect to it, the inspirational aspect. But as we mentioned, there's a downside to that everybody has to be aware of. And that's if the book or if the author is making something out to be too easy and you buy into that idea that it's really that easy, and you find, and you're going to find more often than not, that you're going to fail at trying to do it because it's really not that easy, you are going to pin that failure on yourself. Or you're going to look at it and say, you know, geez, I guess I'm just not good enough. I'm not smart enough. And it could actually have the opposite effect of it. Like you would be worse off because of you read the book as opposed to if you didn't pick up the book at all. Mm-hmm. So that's something to look out for.
Yeah, that's you're just trying to present a reality that there really isn't a reality, and that's not good.
Right.
Yeah, I mean there are some good ideas out there, and I mentioned Martin Seligman and Aaron Beck, et cetera. But they're small things. They're small things that you can do, but they work. To rethink how you're thinking about something into a more constructive way. That's a good thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it going to give you a parking lot space, a space in the parking lot? Okay, well, now you're going off too far there.
Right. That was actually one of the reasons that motivated me to write my book that I wrote, 10 years ago. It was that I've read and listened to well over 100 books and courses. And when I went through all of them, I could just get maybe one, maybe two good ideas. And I realized, what the heck is going on here? You read a book of 400 pages or something, you would expect to get a lot more from it than just, one good idea. If you enjoy reading, and if it motivates you, and if you have the mindset and you understand, a lot of the psychology behind these and a lot of the pseudoscience that they try to throw at you, and you're aware of this, you're reading the book critically, and you're enjoying it, then I don't think a lot of harm could be done. However, if you're not reading these books in critical thinking mode, then you certainly could run into some trouble. All right.
So listen, I want to congratulate you on this very, very successful podcast you've been hosting for how many years?
It's been just under 2 years. I started in March of 2014.
Well, it's given me many a thing to think about as I drive along the highway.
Well, I appreciate
some
that.
Great guests, really, really smart people, very intimidatingly smart people on your podcast. Well, that's a backhanded comment, so I won't. Well, not all of them are so intelligent. But no, you've had some great people and very stimulating conversations over the years.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun talking to a bunch of different people about different ideas, especially I like talking to people that about a topic that I know nothing about. And I think the listeners always like that because I would ask very basic questions. And, you know, it's the curse of knowledge. It's the opposite of that, actually. When you know a lot about a topic, you tend to ask high-level questions, or you don't ask the questions that the audience is thinking. So I actually did appreciate those conversations that I had with people talking about a lot of political things I'm ignorant in, and policy and a lot of that stuff. But it was interesting. It was interesting for me and fun.
Cool.
Enjoyed it. But I thank you for being my last guest here on the Humanist Hour. Before I let you go, why don't you tell our listeners where they could find more stuff about you and what you're doing?
Oh, thanks. If you just Google The Psych Files, you'll find my stuff there. And so, or just go to www.thepsychfiles.com, and that's where you'll find me.
And what is The Psych Files?
Oh, well, that's my podcast that I've been running for way too long. I mean, really long. I mean, well, since 2007, but I'm still having fun with it. And yeah. It's about psychology and everyday life. And we just try to use psychological theories to solve problems.
Right. And if you like this episode, you'll love The Psych Files. It's a lot like that. Sometimes you have guests on. Sometimes you're just chatting away by yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
Good. All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for being with me. It was a lot of fun.
Great. No problem. Thank you.
So I mentioned my book, Year to Success, in our interview. And again, that's a book that I wrote back in 2004. And I need to say that I did revise that book. I completely revised it as of about a year ago and wrote the 10th anniversary edition. I took out all of the pseudoscience I could find, all of the absolutes. I found myself using a lot of absolutes, and that's common in the self-help industry. Like, always do this, never do that, or if you do this, then that will happen. So I changed the language to be a lot more probabilistic. I removed pretty much all of the exaggerations that I could find. I took out several articles in there that were really based on pseudoscience and not backed up by actual facts and data. Another big change that I made in the book was moving away from the idea of success, because that's very nebulous and there's a lot of connotations associated with that, and focused more on well-being, the issue of well-being, the science of well-being, actually. And here's an amusing story for all my secular friends. One time when I was about 12 years old, I guess, I went to a conference with my sister and mother where Zig Ziglar was presenting and speaking. And Zig Ziglar, if you don't know who he was a very charismatic salesperson. He identified as a salesperson. He was big into motivational speaking, clearly. He wrote many different books on the power of selling and so forth. But Zig Ziglar was also an evangelical Christian. And at this seminar, he had a table set aside for free cassette tapes, which were of him preaching how the power of Jesus can help you sell more. And I remember so many people were lined up to grab these tapes. Then they found out what they were, and they just kind of walked away, myself included. So just to be very clear, the Humanist Hour will continue. The Humanist Hour is not going away. I am going away from the Humanist Hour. So it's still going to be here, but it is going to be moving to a bi-weekly format. And you know what? I had to look up that term several times, because I'm always confused with bi-weekly, bi-monthly. What we mean by bi-weekly is once every 2 weeks. So about twice a month, you will have access to a new episode of The Humanist Hour. And interestingly, bi-weekly apparently also means that it could occur twice a week. So again, just to be clear, we're not talking twice a week. We're talking twice a month. And I wanted to do one more plug for the Humanist Conference that is going to be in Chicago. The dates May 26th through 29th of 2016. And it's going to be taking place at the Hyatt Regency McCormick Place Hotel in Chicago, Illinois. Just some of the people who you will see there: Jared Diamond, the Humanist of the Year; Medea Benjamin, Humanist Heroine; John DeLancey, he is getting the Humanist Arts Award; and Elizabeth Loftus, the Isaac Asimov Science Award. And she is largely responsible for hundreds, maybe even thousands, of people who were wrongfully imprisoned being released from prison because of her research on the unreliability of eyewitness testimony. So it is going to be an amazing conference in a wonderful place, Chicago, Illinois. And you have until January 31st to get your tickets at the early bird registration rate. So go to conference.americanhumanist.org and you could click on some of the links there and you could find out more information about it. And you could also register at that early bird rate. Well, that's it for my time on the Humanist Hour, and that's it for this episode. If you do like listening to me and you like critical thinking and science and reason and rationality, well, tune into the Dr. Bo Show. You can get that on iTunes, or you could find it at thedrboshow.com. If you have any feedback on this episode or any others, we'd love to hear from you. Send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. All right, everybody, take care.
Work well on your new costumes, my friends. For when you care for what is outside, what is inside cares for you. Sometimes the true hero is the one with the courage to run away.
I like the way this man thinks.